I would like to...
I shall start with some epistemological and methodological considerations. On several occasions, as his work progressed, Freud declared that psychoanalysis was a bridge, a link, or rather promised to be so, and in being so, acquires a mediating function between the medical sciences, psychopathology, and the sciences of the mind, sciences of culture. Its very essence would consist in this bidirectional deployment. Indeed, as early as the interpretation of dreams on, he maintained that the psychic processes at work in dream work are just active in the production of symptoms as in producing cultural and social phenomena. Consequently, psychoanalysis is not reducible to psychopathology, but it also has things to say about normal psychic functioning and beyond that about socio-cultural creations. Whence the twofold epistemological connection to which the French psychoanalyst Paul-Laurent Assoun refers, which would confer a certain legitimacy upon its practice in the socio-cultural field. Of course, but upon what does he base this assertion? Freud considers that one may assume that the most general facts of unconscious psychic life discovered by psychoanalysis, such as infantile sexuality, drive for conflicts, fantasies, the Oedipus complex, forms of repression and substitutive satisfactions, in particular, are present everywhere, may therefore also be found in the most varied domains of human mental activity, among which he mentioned the existence of many surprising analogies, and I quote Freud. It is the very notion of human mental activity, that of communities and peoples, the unconscious processes and formations of which present analogies with individual psychic life, which authorizes and legitimates Freud's transition from individual psychology to mass psychology, within a perspective, however, common to that developed by the German psychologist Wilhelm Wundt in his Volker Psychology in 1912. However, their treatment of the analogies would prove to be quite different from one another. Thus, the field of symbolism, for example, common to every individual, normal, dreaming, and neurotic, and to every culture, enables Freud to situate psychoanalysis, its main concepts, and its techniques of investigation, in a central position, midway between psychopathology and the cultural sciences. Through the symbolical, the connections are established between individual and collective human realities. It will be the same for religion, the object of analogies with neurotic and psychotic individual formations. In so doing, Freud was not to recognize the distinctive, singular aspects of this socio-cultural reality, either in its modes of functioning or in its productions, which differentiate it radically from individual psychic reality. He would create confusion between the nature of the object, of his psychology of the masses, or of peoples, and that of the two disciplines contemporary with psychoanalysis, sociology and anthropology. As a consequence, his methodology would principally consist in a sudden, direct, massive transfer of notions and concepts stemming from individual psychology, that of dreams and neuroses, to the field of psychology of the masses, therefore actually to the vast domain encompassing society, culture, civilization, community, and the masses, something which specialists in the social sciences would reproach him for as a whole. Nevertheless, Freud was conscious of the risks and difficulties of this methodology. which he expressed in Moses and Mosaism in particular, as well as considering it useless to conceive the existence of a collective unconscious for these masses or peoples, in view of the fact that he considered that the content of the unconscious, and I quote him, the content of the unconscious is generally collective, the universal property of human beings. So it's very different from Jung's conception. It seems to me that, associated with this, is the statement that individual psychology is, I quote him, also, right from the beginning, simultaneously, and I end the quotation, a form of social psychology owing to the significance accorded to the role played by the other person all throughout the subject's life. Freud designated these relations entertained with this other person as being social phenomena, whence an additional confusion in Freudian language with the terminology used by sociologists and anthropologists. I would also like to bring up Freud's need to connect fairly regularly ontogenesis and phylogenesis, the childhood of the individual and the prehistory of peoples of all the human race, in order to explore and make intelligible both the individual psyche and the psyche of the masses. Furthermore, it seems important to me, yes, to recall one of the reasons Freud was interested in this field of the sciences of culture, which was that of helping it to eliminate the quality of strangeness of individual formations, those of neurotic symptoms or dreams, therefore of confirming the validity of the findings of psychoanalysis. Indeed, in his introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, in particular, he spoke of the work of psychoanalysis in which, I quote him, links are formed with numbers of other mental sciences, the investigation of which promises results of the greatest value, links with mythology and philology, with folklore, with social psychology, and the theory of religion. End of quotation. He then explained that, again, quotation, in all these links, the share of psychoanalysis is, in the first instance, that of giver, and not, and only, to a less extent, that of receiver. It is true that this brings it an advantage in the fact that its strange findings become more familiar when they are met with again in other fields. But on the whole, it is psychoanalysis which provides the technical methods and the points of view whose application in these other fields should prove fruitful. End of quotation. Very interesting. In contrast to Jung, he couldn't, therefore, envision mutual input on either the epistemological, methodological, or conceptual plan, something which must raise questions for us regarding his genuine interest for society and culture. And yet, he devoted numerous works to it. This is to say that he had all the same rather many other reasons for being interested, in particular that concerning the major role played by society and culture, or formulated otherwise in his metapsychology, by reality and the external world, in the construction of every person's differentiated psychic apparatus, determining his or her humanization and conditioning his or her socialization, something partially accounted for, according to my personal research, by the notion of Kulturarbeit that he introduced, beginning with the interpretation of dreams. In fact, I think that very early on, he perceived and understood the relations of interdependence and interpenetration between the two domains, individual and collective, psychic and sociocultural, without being able either to formulate them or to conceptualize them in that way, because he was inspired by the individual society antagonism prevailing in the social and intellectual ideology of his time, something that can also help us understand his transition and his rough transfer of concepts of individual psychology to mass psychology. Yes, but by the way, what society and of what culture are we talking about? Was it in fact his society, the Viennese society, in which he grew up, lived, and created psychoanalysis? As for his culture, we could distinguish between the one he belonged to and the one that served as a reference. Thus, he belonged to Jewish culture, that of the liberal Viennese middle bourgeoisie, more specifically, that of the scientific and medical milieu, and to the Germanic culture, while he readily made reference to Greco-Roman culture. However, like every thinker of his time, he asked himself about Western society and civilization, experiencing critical periods, generating discontent and change, just as he was interested in historical and primitive societies from the evolutionist perspective of the British anthropologists of his time, which enabled him to fabricate the myth, telling of the conditions of the creation of human culture, culture in itself, with its primordial institutions and social organization, by establishing the Oedipus complex in its foundations. So, when Freud dealt with society, culture, civilization, the masses or the community, I consider it necessary to take into consideration an interrelationship between these different levels, contemporary Viennese and Western, historical and primitive, finally the general categories of society, culture, and civilization. Now, let's look at Freudian society and culture, because you are very curious. So, I would like to fulfill your curiosity. In the first place, society and culture prove to be omnipresent and omnipotent for us, both in psychoanalysis and in Freud's life's work, in particular through reality and the external world, terms belonging to metapsychological language on the basis of which the ego is differentiated from the id of every individual and, collectively, the substitution of the reality principle for the pleasure principle effected what Freud considered to be a psychic revolution, leading to the transformation of the pleasure ego into a reality ego. These expressions principally designate socio-cultural reality and less frequently nature or material reality. Society and culture are the sources and places of external real necessity, or the power of the present, of constraints, demands, and failures to provide satisfaction, but also of drive satisfaction and of actions, particularly aiming at adaptations, modifications, even mastery and sought after satisfaction. From that point on, they will compel each person to engage ongoing psychic work throughout his or her entire life. Furthermore, as his writing progresses, Freud presents evolving personal conceptions independent of the theorizing of the sociologists and anthropologists who were his contemporaries, among whom may be cited Durkheim and Mauss, leaders of the French school of sociology, who revolutionized sociology. And in Germany, Weber, Tonnies, Simmel in particular. While among the anthropologists, the English school, with the first generation led by Taylor and Fraser, and the second generation, with Rivers and Seligman, was dominant. It is a matter of socio-anthropology, that is, psychoanalytic in essence, of course, both through its epistemological foundations, its method, and through its conceptual language, which fails to take into account the distinctiveness of the functioning and the singular products of this other reality, which is just as complex as psychic reality, systemic and symbolic in nature, and shot through with multiple antagonisms, as Durkheim and Mauss discovered and maintained in exemplary fashion. Indeed, Durkheim found that generally, and up until that time, sociologists, but also the English school of anthropology, as well as Wundt's Volker psychology, had only viewed social phenomena as derived, that is to say, extended and generalized mental facts. However, he established the existence of a line of demarcation between the former and the latter, analogous to that separating the biological realm from the mineral realm, and he laid down the rule that a social phenomenon can only be produced by another social phenomenon, as well as establishing the principle of the interdependence of these phenomena, then forming a system. Considering that English anthropology was not a social science, he envisaged introducing the sociological method into it. An idea adopted and applied by Bronislaw Malinowski and Radcliffe Brown, and by imposing this, he thus hastened anthropology's transition to another phase of its history, in particular to functionalism, precisely that developed by Radcliffe Brown and Malinowski, which was later adopted by British social anthropology. From this perspective, the spirit of Freudian socio-anthropology was in line with what? With that of English anthropology, which, by the way, greatly inspired Totem and Taboo. Freud, in fact, borrowed from it principally, first, its system of construction of insufficiently scrutinized, imprecise socio-cultural facts taken out of their social context. Then, the explanation, interpretation, consisting of always finding the individual mental processes one believes to be the basis of social fact, something which converged with the hypothesis he wished to validate. And finally, he borrowed their mode of reconstructing the past, a history not attested to by any document, in short, the writing of historical novels. However, in other respects, Freudian thought reveals itself to be a product of historically and socio-culturally determined thought that shows evidence of certain social and ideological representations prevalent in his time, but also in Viennese society undergoing a serious crisis. Let me indicate in particular the radical antagonism between individual and society, as well as the evolutionist ideology in its developmental version, that is to say, the development of society is comparable to that of an individual, and progressive version, that is to say, evolution is animated by the progress sustained by the triumph of reason, dogma prevailing during the 19th century, and appropriated by the liberal bourgeois members of his society. So it is that I have detected an evolving progression of his discourse inherent to the very evolution of psychoanalytic doctrine, be it the theory of drives or of the psychic apparatus, for example. This is why I shall distinguish, if you agree, or not, never mind, between two periods. The first one, that of the first topic, with some major texts, including three essays on the theory of sexuality, 1905, Civilized Sexual Morality and Modern Nervous Illness, 1908, Totem and Taboo, and that of the second topic, dominated by three texts, but to which I shall add a fourth, A Short Account of Psychoanalysis. It's a jewel. Wonderful, this text. 1924. The Future of an Illusion, 1927. Civilization is its Contents, 1930. And Mothers and Motherism, 1939. So, let's look at the first period. Very early on, Freud defended the thesis of the libidinal drive foundations of culture that he would later define as his psychic capital, which is not very surprising for a psychoanalyst unaware of socio-anthropological theorizations, of course. Indeed, as early as the three essays, cultural productions are a matter of acquired sexual components, forces of sexual drives, diverted from their sexual aim and directed towards new, non-sexual aims through the process of sublimation, individual as well as collective. In so doing, he affirmed, on the one hand, that this process participates in the constitution of culture, and, on the other hand, that it is a matter of production that is collective through the participation of each of its members. Consequently, these drive components, sublimated or inhibited, even repressed with respect to their aim, objects of forms of renunciation and refashioning, represent the culture's psychic capital, which must necessarily take a great quantity of psychic energy away from the sexuality of its participants for its own needs of consumption. This economic drive approach of culture is also particularly manifest in his Sexual Morality of 1908. While a culture is generally built upon the repression of drives, it is also a question of each person's personal gift of a part of his or her drive capital, libidinal and hostile motions, which will therefore represent every individual's contribution to the constitution of this common cultural property in material and ideal goods. It's the expression of Freud. As a genuine participant in the constitution of the culture in question, which is a collective enterprise and common property. This very notion of common cultural property would be neglected during the second period. In addition, he emphasized that through the repression and displacement of drives, normal sexuality would bring the culture to advance, in contrast to the perverse deviations in conflict with it through their incapacity to mobilize these sexual components. Moreover, Freud plainly states that a drive's cultural value lies in its capacity for displacement of the object and aim. In Totem and Taboo, through analogy with the neurotic symptomatic formations, the primordial institutions have an animal origin in drives. They appertain to drive conflicts in the spaces that are edible in nature and constitute compromise social solutions to the problem of wish compensation. Realized collectively, they represent goods of humanity. But above all, his method led him to set up the ambivalent paternal side of the Oedipus complex at the foundation of culture, then as an agent of liaison between the two fields, intrapsychic individual and collective sociocultural, from a certain number of needs, capacities, and processes of human mental activity, but also taking into consideration an essential analogy between the individual and society, that of a psyche, individual in the former case, and math, in the latter case, within which we inevitably find similar processes, individual psyche and culture are creative, therefore interdependent. Finally, the introduction of the notion of a mass psyche, ensuring the continuity of psychic life between generations, is an extension of Wundt's notion of collective psyche as an extension of the individual psyche. It displays similarities with that of collective consciousness introduced by Durkheim in 1893. As I have already formulated it, it pertains to the culture and represents an instance of it by referring to human mental activity. It does not stand in a relationship of identity with the individual psyche, as group psychoanalysts have shown well, contrary to what Freud had imagined. In fact, its processes and its formations are distinctive of it, even though some analogies exist between these two psychic realities, individual and collective. Are you ready for the second period? Yes. Okay. I'm ready too. Freud's short account, 1924, I recommend you to read it, or reread it, because it's very nice, presents culture as the domain of expression of human mental activity, presupposing a projective activity of external shaping of the internal world involving three portions corresponding to three areas of its representation of culture. The first one is combat with reality, nature, determining a community of work and interests of libidinously linked human beings and a correlative social life. Second one, the substitutive satisfactions of repressed wishes, figuring among them myth, literary and artistic creations. And the third one, the major institutions that enable mastery of the Oedipus complex and the individual libidos, transition from its infantile liaisons to wished for social liaisons. Then, with the future of an illusion and civilization is its contents, Freud plunges us into an elaborate description and exposes us to some structural antagonisms between culture or society and its members, as well as to paradoxes intrinsic to the culture or society itself. First of all, he paints a picture for us of the overall culture involving, once again, three areas. The first one, material aspects proceeding from two types of activities, those that are useful, vital in nature, enabling the acquisition and fabrication of goods and referring to the material culture, and those that are useless, but nevertheless necessary to human beings, among them beauty, order, and cleanliness. Second one is the intellectual aspects or psychic goods, integrating religious systems, philosophical speculation, artistic creations, as well as the formations of ideal or store of mankind's cultural ideals and the human superego as, I quote him, psychological cultural capital. The third one is what pertains to modes of regulating social relations ensured by ethics or morality, one of the expressions of the culture's superego, Freud would point out to us in Civilization and its contents, which produces its ideals and raises its demands. What are its principal antagonisms and paradoxes which are the source of conflicts and of ambivalence with regard to it? First one is nature-culture antagonism. If the true foundation of the existence of the culture which blends in with its principal task consists of a community of work and human interests associated together by identifications, aim, intimidated relations, and sublimated homosexual bonds, essentially aiming at protecting them from the dangers of nature and at dominating it in order to obtain vital goods, then it is also a source of multiple forms of suffering by the determining of a twofold coercion to work, both psychic, sublimational for example, and social, individual and collective, and by the instinctual renunciation required therefore engendering sacrifices. The second one is the individual society culture antagonism. But it is also threatened within by another source of danger. It must protect itself from its participants, human individuals endowed with tribes of animal origin, therefore with that are called antisocial drives, sexual as well as destructive, that make virtual enemies of them, not to mention their narcissism, which must be held in check and changed into love of object, whence love as a factor of culture. Wonderful, isn't it? Freud ultimately identified two sources of hostility of individuals from which culture must protect itself. That inherent to the animal nature of human beings, constituted of selfish, very dangerous, sexual and destructive, antisocial and anti-cultural drives in search of satisfaction and confronted with privations established by the basic prohibitions. And that determined by the constraint of individual and collective work and the requisite drive renunciation, which engenders psychic sacrifices in its participants, determining a position virtually hostile to culture and its demands. Its modalities of protection are also multiple. It must compensate those participating in it for the sacrifices of drive it imposes on them by offering them psychic goods, in fact having this purpose, according to Freud, just like the institutions, devices, and commandments. Nevertheless, culture's most determinant and meaningful method of protection against its participants' destructive drive, destruction drive, the most dangerous one, would be considered the establishment of the superego or conscience in each individual, thus becoming a bearer, a vehicle of the culture and of the correlative advent of a sense of guilt. Culture, work of eros and serving it, goes hand in hand with this feeling of guilt, which inevitably induces a loss of happiness. This is the very purpose of Kulturarbeit in both its individual and collective field. For each society, it will therefore be a matter of finding modes of balancing these two sorts of demands, individual and collective. Among the other socio-cultural antagonisms that I have detected, I would like to indicate that between women, as representing the interests of the family and of sexual life and the culture, that between the family from which young people must break away, helped in this task by the rights of puberty instituted by the society and the culture, that between men and women in their relationship to the culture and to Kulturarbeit, that between Kulturarbeit and sexuality through the necessary work of drive sublimation, which impoverishes the erotic drive capital and its dangers of drive diffusion, that between homosexual ties that are sublimated and inhibited with respect to the goal prevailing within the community of work and human interests, and the heterosexuality of conjugal bonds, and finally, that between sexuality as an autonomous source of pleasure and marriage. Indeed, society would impose upon all its members the same kind of genital sexual life based on the choice of one or two heterosexual object, therefore ruling out multiplicity of choice, the homosexual object, and perversions, and a relationship between one man and one woman, principally procreative and indissoluble, within the framework of the institution of marriage. But Freud also proposed a dynamic vision of culture as process, work of eros that urges human beings to bond libidinally among themselves in order to form great social units. Consequently, eros and ananke are the parents of human culture. This process develops on the scale of humanity and seems analogous to individual development and to organic processes. Indeed, having to confront a major obstacle, the destructive instinct, it will therefore be a matter of a combat animated by necessary movements of fusion, diffusion, refusion between eros and this destructive instinct, corresponding thus to the essential content of life. In Moser's Animal Theism, Freud reminds us that at work in the psychic life of the individual are not only contents experienced by himself or herself, but also innate contents, memory traces bound to an experience lived by earlier generations, continuing to persist as elements of phylogenetic origin and constituting an archaic heritage. For Freud, this notion of archaic heritage seems to represent an agent of liaison between phylogenesis and ontogenesis, as well as individual and collective psychologies. Moreover, if the foundations of the culture condition and favor, through the constraint of drive, restrictions in particular, the outbreak of neurosis in its participants, and if the analogy between cultural development and that of the individual, particularly based on certain similar processes, presents a value, Freud allows himself to infer the possible existence of neurotic cultures and cultural eras under the influence of tendencies of culture. Thus, culture produces individual neurosis, but also collective neurosis. And this idea will be taken up again by Georges Devreux. I don't know if you know Georges Devreux. He was an anthropologist, famous American anthropologist and psychoanalyst, and he developed an ethnopsychiatry. Now, let's discuss shortly the Freudian notion of Kulturarbeit. It runs through all of Freud's work, from the interpretation of dreams on, even if it is not often designated as such. As I have identified it, this notion expresses the existence of relationships of interdependency and interpenetration between socio-cultural and psychic and bodily individual realities. And the originality of Freudian thought is to have indicated to us the diverse modes of living its imprint and of individual transmission, bodily as well as intrapsychic, of what is cultural and social, as well as signifying to us that this introjection of social aspects and of culture conditions the constitution of a differentiated psychic apparatus. Therefore, the psychic hominization of every individual that would permit his or her socialization, therefore his or her incorporation into society, conferring upon him or her the status of person or of subject. Thus, these subjects would participate in the collective work of a social nature which is productive, preserving, and reproductive for their society and culture, their common property. What conclusion could I propose? With methodological impertinence, which is historically determined, Freud would have established some foundations of a necessary psychoanalytical approach to society and culture that would be taken up again and developed by other authors from varied perspectives. We may cite, in particular, Geza Hoheim, Abraham Gardiner, and Georges Devreux. I plan to pursue this exploration in the work of these authors, as well as in that of contemporary authors. Nevertheless, it seems to me urgent, on the one hand, to elaborate a heuristic psychoanalytic methodology, which group psychoanalysts have initiated, on the other hand, to combine within the framework of plurality and interdisciplinary collaboration the individual and group psychoanalytic approach to historical as well as to sociological, anthropological, and linguistic approaches within the perspective of a genuinely pertinent and fruitful investigation of the complexity of this human reality. I thank you for your careful attention. And I would be happy to welcome your questions. Even if I'm aware that it's a paper a little bit difficult, but never mind. Yes, it comes from three essays on theory of sexuality. Yes. You know, it's very interesting because very often psychoanalysts are focused on certain topics, certain problematics, issues, etc., and they read in a certain direction. Freudian writings, and when you are concerned by a certain issue, you will read on a certain direction, and you neglect the other aspects. And usually, as I told to one colleague just before, I gave the same lecture at the British Psychoanalytical Association 2 months ago. On Saturday morning, and they were around 10. And they told me, only women, and they told me, you know, Eric, we are sorry, but we are especially interested in clinical, but not in theory, and less in culture. So that's why we are not very numerous today. But it was very sunny this Saturday morning. but I know that in Great Britain, but even in France, we are very interested in theory, in culture, etc. But I think in Great Britain and in the United States, for example, they are not very, they don't seem very interested in this aspect of the work of Freud, and it's a pity because He wrote very important papers. He elaborated very important ideas in order to understand the constitution and the conditions of the constitution of the psychic apparatus. The major role, as I told you, of reality, of society, of culture, it runs throughout his work from the beginning to the end.
Why do you think is that the British culture is not that interested in hearing?
I don't know. But you know, I don't know, but in France we have the reputation that we are focused, we are very interested in theory. We have a theoretical mode of functioning, etc. But in Great Britain, you are interested in theory, but you are especially focused, interested in clinic, material, clinical material, maybe there's an explanation, a historical explanation, maybe, because when Freud tried to understand society with his psychoanalytical tools, he was mistaken, and he was rejected by anthropologists, sociologists, the specialists of social sciences. He was rejected. And I think the psychoanalytic community was really wounded, and therefore they were obliged, constrained to focus on the clinical material which is specific to psychoanalysis. Maybe, I don't know, because in France, there are some psychoanalysts who try to understand society, culture, certain aspects of society, culture, with psychoanalytical tool, psychoanalytic thought, but it's difficult, it's really difficult.
I think a lot of things were yeah. I mean, I'm a great fan of theory. I'm a great fan of theory. I love theory. but also, I would like to see like how can this be applied. And what came to my mind was if maybe Freud had something to say about the state of peace and war as a collective state of mind, of the collective conscience. Is there anything in his work that topic that you would come to your mind?
What is your question exactly? I don't understand.
If war and peace, mm-hmm, as a state of the collective conscience, if there's some ties in his work takes this into consideration, that where he writes about like peoples at war, mm-hmm, what is this like hysteria, or what's happening in the conscience, in the collective conscience when such things break out, such phenomena? Mm-hmm.
Je comprends pas bien sa question. Qu'est-ce qu'il veut dire,
je pense que qu'est-ce qui se passe quand il y a une guerre, quand il y a quelque chose, qu'est-ce qui se passe au niveau.
I think in this kind of situation, collective situation, there's, as group psychoanalysts have shown very well, we can notice some regression phenomenon to regressive positions like psychotic positions, and it's very. For this kind of issue, Melanie Klein was very determinant with the two positions, paranoid and depressive positions. And it's funny what you say, because as I'm a couple psychoanalyst, I notice that in critical periods of couple life, that it's a war between the two partners, and there's a regression to a psychotic, paranoid position. The other partner, the partner, is an enemy. And at a collective level, or a society, for example, you can find some processes referring to this kind of position.
Can I ask a question regarding the relationship between individual and mass psychology?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering to what extent mass psychology can reinforce individual psychology, because we I seem to formulate my question properly.
Slower, please, because my listening is a little bit not weak, but I need to understand.
So it's regarding the relationship between,
yes,
individual and mass psychology. Could we argue that a similar psychic revolution that you refer to that has occurred or can occur regarding the Oedipal complex itself. Given the fact that Freud, or the reading of Freud, is so entrenched in contemporary culture, does it not stand to reason that it it doesn't exist in the same way as such an unconscious exploit of archaeology that it used to, given the fact that there is so much reading of Freud prevalent? So I'm just wondering whether you think the popularity of Freudian theory itself necessitates a revision of the Oedipal complex.
J'ai pas bien compris ce que tu as dit. I'm sorry. Tu as compris? Parce que j'ai pas bien compris ce que. I'm sorry, but en plus je suis fatigué.
I'm wondering so the points at which the Oedipal complex becomes such a symbolized thing in itself in contemporary culture, does it not negate the idea that it's always this root cause of neurosis that needs to be unearthed in the individual? If the individual is raised in a culture which is so en masse aware of it.
And what happens with the place
of Oedipal complex? Yeah, I guess. Or just does it need revision? Does Freudian theory need revision?
Quelle est la question juste?
Si le rôle d'Oedipe peut être calqué en fait à une échelle plus importante.
Donc elle veut parler là, donc do you mean in fact, do you mean precisely in the collective dimension of Oedipus complex? No?
Yeah, or more precisely
how
yes. Does the collective position reinforce the individual position?
Oh.
When an individual is raised in a culture which is so aware of it collectively.
C'est la relation entre. Attends, parce que je voudrais avoir.
The collective unconscious impact on the individual, yeah? In what ways, or how much, or what is it? Yeah?
And just, I know, it's very.
Would it be something like in the kids?
I think we can look at it as culture exists now, because
yeah.
I mean the fact that we're having this conversation, and the fact that it's, you know, for the most part contemporary culture has accepted Freud and rejected, but has gone through the process of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
This primary trauma that was at one point it has been unearthed. It has been unearthed in contemporary culture. So what reverse effects does that have on individual consciousness,
I suppose? Quelle est sa question? I have my two colleagues who can help me to try to understand your question and to try to answer you precisely.
But the way I understand it is that she's saying that on the individual level, back in the time of Freud,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was like a historic configuration in that time. And then, as time moves on, people were talking about Freud and studying it, and it became part of the collective conscience, right? And then the question is, does it not backfire, but does it have any impact on the Oedipus complex on an individual level, because everyone knows about it and it society. So is it a universal thing? Or is it just in that historic situation when Freud was alive? Or has it moved on? Has it become something else?
Has it transformed itself at the same time? All right. Can I push the relevance or something like that?
Yeah, I suppose, in a way. It occurs to me that maybe we need to see it historically to an extent. That maybe individual neurosis might be replaced over time with something else once on a collective level it has been on that.
Alors donc quelle est sa question précise? J'ai compris ça, mais j'ai pas compris la question.
Non,
je vois pas la question encore.
Est-ce que le fait de répéter ce mythe d'Oedipe et tous ces effets-là a un effet sur comment l'individu se perçoit en relation avec ce mythe?
Comment l'individu se perçoit?
C'est-à-dire que ça devient de plus en plus présent. Je pense que c'est ça.
Oui, ok. No, because I was wondering about different possibilities of answer depending to your question. So, depending to my understanding of your question. So, I have different answers, if you want. The first one is, you know, Oedipus complex is very complicated. And I think that we speak a lot about Oedipus complex, but we don't understand very well what is it exactly. And because in the history of psychoanalysis, you can find several theories, several understandings of Oedipus complex. And moreover, so there are different theories. We can speak about, from Freud, we can speak about the individual dimension of Oedipus complex and the collective dimension, social dimension of Oedipus complex. And it started with Totem and Taboo. Totem and Taboo was very important in the history of the human sciences, even if he made many mistakes, never mind, because Freud introduced the genius idea of the presence of certain aspects of the Oedipus complex, which is individual, psychic structure, at the foundation of every society. Through what? Through the institutions, in fact. So, when we speak about Oedipus complex, we have to clarify, is it the individual dimension, the psychic structure, the psychic organizer of every human being, or do we speak about the social aspect presence of Oedipus complex? But we can't speak about complex in the society. We speak about Oedipal aspects presence through institutions, through different forms of symbolizations. And 2 years ago, I was invited in New Delhi for a colloquium, international conference between French and Indian. And Indian psychoanalyst. And the Indian psychoanalyst is very interesting because the first Indian psychoanalyst was in exchanges, used to exchange letters with Freud, Bose. He's called Bose. He lived in Calcutta, and he tried to make an analysis with Freud through letters. But he was especially interested in his Indian culture, with Indian mythology. Why I tell you that? I tell you that because when we spoke with Indian psychoanalysts, they are not very interested in clinic, but in their culture. And they use psychoanalysis as a good tool to investigate their mythology. So, through their mythology, they discover that they believe that they have discovered that Oedipus complex, contrary to Freud thought, isn't universal. In India, there's no Oedipus complex, because in mythology, in Indian mythology, there's no Oedipus complex. There's no Oedipus complex. We can't find the Western model of the Oedipus complex. We find something different. And I told to my colleagues, you make a confusion between the psychic organizer and the collective symbolizations. And in fact, when you find different configurations of Oedipus complex in different kinds of societies, culture, etc., it doesn't it doesn't mean that there's no universality of the Oedipus complex. It means that there's a confusion, a risk of confusion between the psychic dimension, which is universal, because it's a psychic organizer of every human being, and the social symbolizations of this structure within the society and culture. Because every society produces symbolizations in order to live together through institutions, etc., through a specific social organization and social familial organization too. So you can find different configurations of family or different groups, etc., but it doesn't mean that it doesn't invalidate the universal structure of the Oedipus complex, in fact. So there's if we speak about nowadays of the contemporary society, indeed in my in one of my papers I speak about it's a paper about couples, contemporary couples, and I notice that in our Western contemporary society, you can find less and less Oedipal aspects of Oedipal aspects, but as well as in the individual field as in the social field, because we have to distinguish the individual psychic field, individual, and the collective field, social field. And every society is organized by certain aspect of Oedipal complex. But in this society, we are confronted to certain aspects which are especially perverse and narcissistic, with certain manic defenses and less aspects, less Oedipal aspects. That's why, and your question is very interesting, because that's why we can find less and less neurotic structures, organizations in our patients, and more a blend, a mixture between neurotic aspects, of course, and borderline aspects, narcissistic and identity issues, problematics, you know. And there's a mixture of those different aspects. And you can find some impacts on couples, because I'm interested in couples, in families. That's why, for example, it's a detail. But that's why you can understand the very changeable aspects of the relationship between two partners, conjugal life is very unstable. It's very unstable because it lacks the solidity of the Oedipal structure, for example. No, it's Freud and culture today. Tonight it's Freud and culture. Freud and culture.
No, it's culture, really culture.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, so since does Freud have some explanation about how the model, I know that he wasn't a contemporary with Sachs, but does he have some explanation about how the model, how Simone de Beauvoir and Sachs, their relationship wouldn't work in most couples, basically, because maybe this is something about culture. We didn't go out of the culture topic. Do you think Freud has some explanation about, even regarding what you said, that couples nowadays or families lack the Oedipal solidity, etc.? So do you think there's a certain explanation?
Freud wasn't a specialist of couples.
Sorry?
Freud wasn't a specialist of couples. Wasn't a specialist of couples.
Yeah, but his view of the world was basically about things about passions and that the human being is a sexual being, etc. So
it's
possessivity, etc.
I think, in fact, your question, precisely, what is it?
My question is
precisely:
would anything in Freud's writing,
yes,
justify the fact that the structure of the couple of Sachs and de Beauvoir, was based on kind of freedom, wouldn't work in couples, in normal couples somehow?
Alors, the couple Sachs Simone de Beauvoir was a very avant-gardist couple, and Freud was a very traditional. He belonged to a bourgeoisie. He had a couple, a very traditional couple, and he was very attached to this structure. And your question is very interesting because you can find that in the couple Freud created with and experienced with Martha was really a bourgeois couple, very bourgeois couple, and he belonged to his time. And Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir didn't belong to their time, but were avant-gardist. And maybe Freud couldn't have understood this kind of structure of couple, because it's too difficult to understand this kind of relationship, I think. They hadn't any children.
No, and it's just before 68, and it's just the time of change, which we now, as you said,
because a sign of the presence of Oedipus complex is to have children.
Yeah.
The triangulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a sign. You know, Simone de Beauvoir had some homosexual tendencies, and Sartre flies from woman to woman. So
they even share sometimes the same woman. This is so funny. Yeah, sorry.
It's another culture. society.
Maybe that's why it didn't compass with me that probably.
You mentioned the, I think you mentioned the sexual, no, say you mentioned 68, like, I think maybe the sexual revolution was a shift in the conscience, the collective conscience. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and those two were definitely ahead of their times. So I don't think, like, Freud could have foreseen that sexual revolution, and not to mention all the consequences that arise from it.
Sure.
I hope my question is simpler than the previous. You described in your paper that Freud interpreted culture as somehow a source of unhappiness for people because it might suppress the desire of people and so on through all the social and cultural rules. And so one is left with a sense of negativity when trying to understand what is culture, especially after reading the civilization and its discontents. I think that the main impression is somehow an unpleasant feeling. Mm-hmm. But also you described that there is a process. Mm-hmm. I mean that Freud see culture through a process. Mm-hmm. Can you say a bit more about that? I mean, if there is any positive aspect and any positive approach to culture.
In fact, if today...
Just to say that many Freud received a lot of criticism about that. Mm-hmm.
In fact, if we take into consideration today the writing, the Freudian writings, we could understand much better what happens today in our society, because we are regularly astonished, surprised by the destructivity of human beings. But it's part of every society. It's part of human beings. Love, destructivity, and the process of life is creation, destruction, recreation. And we live in a society with different, these ambivalent movements. But we are surprised, but you know, if you read some historical writings, you are not surprised. Because if you lived at the middle age, it was more aggressive, more violent. The creation and the constitution of the state, it's a revolution in the history of the world, of the societies, of the nations. The creation of a state. Because before the creation of a state, in every society, the violence was permanent. And the creation, we say, you know, there's I recommend you to read, if you're interested and if you have time, to read some writings by Norbert Elias, the German sociologist. He wrote a wonderful book, wonderful books, La Civilisation des Mœurs, Civilization of des Mœurs. Customs, etc. And he explained. In fact, it's historical sociology of the Middle Age and Renaissance, etc. And he described the evolution from Middle Age until the 19th and 20th century. And he said that there's an interrelationship between the sociogenesis of the state and the social structures and the psychic structures. And we can reproach Freud not to notice, to consider that, for example, certain psychic agencies like superego, for example, superego is evolving, in fact. And you can't find the same kind of superego in different social, cultural, or historical context. He used to live in a certain society, Viennese society, where the superego was very strict, very, very strict, but you can find different society where people have another kind of superego, and from a historical point of view, for example, you can imagine that in the Middle Age, it was very different. It doesn't mean that there was no superego, but it was different because there's this kind of interrelationship between individual and society, culture. And the culture, the society, shapes the individual. It's very important. But the individual produces society. It's part of it. So there's a circularity between individual and society. It's very important to consider that. But it's very important to consider the historical point of view. Because we live in a society at this time, but it was different in the Middle Age, in the Antiquity, etc. It's very different. So the psychic life, the psychic organization was quite different too, certainly.
The content, not the structure.
The content, the form, and content. Form and content. Content. The structure, there's also, Freud has discovered certain basic aspects of the psyche apparatus. But based on that, id, ego, superego, yeah, you can find variations, of course. But the mistake is to transfer these psychic agencies to the society. It's impossible because in society we deal with institutions and not with superego, ego. It's ridiculous to transfer this concept, this psychic components. It's because it's epistemologically speaking. It's epistemologically speaking a big mistake, a serious mistake.
And sometimes the institutions take the function of the superego.
What did you say? Sorry.
Sometimes
yes.
The institutions
yes.
Function as if they are.
Yes, yes, of course, but it's not superego.
Okay.
It's different. It's different. For example, the institution of the law, institution, people like law, art, morality. In my book, I wrote about that. It's an institution, and the law functions. Has the role of superego, for example, within a society, in a collective frame. Have you got another question? Bon.